WHYY is proudly supported by Penn Medicine. From groundbreaking discoveries to life-saving care, Penn Medicine's innovation is helping to change lives, one moment, one treatment, one patient at a time.
Nearly 10 years ago, journalist Mark Hertzgaard started traveling the world to investigate an urgent story. As he writes in his new book, Earth Odyssey, the question driving him was whether the human species will survive the many environmental pressures crowding in on it at the end of the 20th century. Hertzgaard has covered the environment and other topics for such publications as The New Yorker, The New York Times, and The Atlantic Monthly. He's also the author of three previous books, including On Bended Knee, About the Reagan Presidency, and Nuclear Inc., The Men and Money Behind Nuclear Energy. He says that often reporting on the environment is so abstract and scientific, it leaves him cold. In Earth Odyssey, he takes the issue down to a personal level by writing about the experiences he had traveling to many of the world's most polluted and environmentally devastated places, including China, the Sudan, the former Soviet Union, and Brazil. He says that seeing firsthand how severely people suffer in the developing world reminded him how we all were once at the mercy of the elements before technology. I asked him how this long view of environmental history changed his ideas about global environmental challenges facing us today.
Well, to me, it made me realize that the biggest environmental problem in the world today is not global warming, it's not ozone depletion, it's not species loss, as serious as all of those are. The biggest environmental problem today is poverty, because about 4 to 5 out of every 6 people on this planet live, by American standards, very impoverished lives. And when you travel in places like the Sudan, in places like China, where I also spent a lot of time, you realize that those people, quite understandably, are determined to improve their lot in life. And that is going to cause environmental consequences, even if you use green technology. So the big challenge, I think, facing humans in the next century is to find a way to accommodate that understandable desire for a better life that so many of us have with the carrying capacity of the planet.
You found that the Chinese have a saying that they say, "Is your stomach too full?" Now, is that what they say when Americans talk about saving animals, saving birds, saving species?
Yeah, not just Americans. That is a very strong perception inside of China that hey, we have been poor for a very long time. You know, it's really only in the last 20 years that the majority of the Chinese people have been more or less warm in the wintertime. One of the great joys of this trip was to meet the individuals that I traveled with. And my interpreter in China was a great guy, very funny guy named Jen Bin. And he had grown up very, very poor in a village north of Beijing. And up until the age of about 12, and this is in a climate that's probably about as cold as Boston, the only thing his family had to stay warm with in the winter was to burn leaves and to burn corn stalks. As a result, the inside of their hut was often white with frost. Now, if you multiply that reality by about 1.2 billion people in China, you understand why today, when there's a little bit of money and the economy is beginning to grow, people are not only burning coal, but they will also tell you, in addition to, "Is your stomach too full?" They'll say, "Look, I am used to it, and I will put up with this bad air pollution and this bad water pollution." Not that they like it, but it is a lot better than freezing through every winter.
Is there also the idea that you can, as you say, you can get used to anything, and you can also adapt to anything, that bad air that might harm you as a stranger, as a Westerner in China, that their bodies have adapted to that and they can live with it?
Yes, although, I'll tell you a funny story about Jen Bin. When we were in the southwestern Chinese city of Chongqing, which Americans who've been to China will know as the place where you take the boat rides to go down the Yangtze River. We were there, and we'd been traveling together for quite a while by then, and we uncovered this factory. In fact, it's the opening scene in the book, this factory that the local officials had said, "Oh, we closed this. This shows what good environmentalists we are." And we went there ourselves and sort of snuck our way in and saw that out the back of the factory was pouring literally a huge waterfall of chlorine into this river that was going to be people's drinking water. That night, Jianbin and I were out at a restaurant and having dinner, and he would, because I couldn't read Chinese, he would always suggest, okay, well, here's the menu, let's try this, this, and this. And he suggested fish. And I said, Jianbin, are you crazy? You know, that fish has to have come out of the Yangtze, and didn't you see what I saw today? And he said, well, if you don't want it, we don't have to have it, but I think it's pretty similar to what I eat in Beijing, and I'm used to it. And we went back and forth. I said, just because you think you're used to it doesn't mean it's good for you. And as we went back and forth, I finally realized that he was really still speaking as the peasant that he had been brought up with being, and did not understand the biology of cancer. He was thinking back to when you're a kid. He says, you know, I never take cold pills in the winter. I just build up my body's tolerance. Well, that works fine with influenza. It does not work with cancer. And, you know, what? Finally, I was able to get the point across to him when I said, look, Jianbin, by that reckoning, smoking cigarettes would be fine as long as you started at the age of 8. And that finally broke through to him. Now, I hasten to add, he is an extremely well-educated person by Chinese standards. He went to graduate school in London, and yet he had never learned this very basic fact. And that's part of the real big problem in China. People think they can make themselves, as they say, used to it. And they just don't know better.
Let's talk about some of the other countries you visited with some bad air problems. Greece came up. I think somebody said, look, soon you won't be able to see the Acropolis till you stumble over it. It's so bad there. Did the people that you talked to in Greece have a different take on their air pollution problems than, say, the Chinese? Did you see real cultural divides or differences among people and how they justify or relate to the daily effects of pollution in their environment?
There were differences. The Greeks, of course, aren't as impoverished as the Chinese, and so their take on it is a little bit different. Everybody will complain about how dirty the air is in Athens, or in Paris, for that matter, or in London. I mean, air pollution of major cities is now an absolutely international phenomenon. What is interesting and what is common, in my experience throughout the world, is that it is always the other guy's fault. Nobody wants to stop driving their own car into Athens. And as illustrated by the fact that when it got to be really bad, and we're talking, you know, 800 people dying in one terrible two-week period in Athens because of this air inversion and the pollution, the government said, okay, we've got to do something. We're going to set up a system where the only people who can drive their cars into the city on Monday are people with odd-numbered license plates, and on Tuesday it'll be even numbers. So the idea was to cut the traffic down by 50%. Well, what did people do? They started stopping in. They're set up a ring all the way around the city. These mechanics would set up right outside the city limits, and for $20, you could come in. If you had the wrong numbered license plate, you could get them to put new plates on that you could drive into the city, and then they'd come out at night and they'd take them back off, and for $20, you were able to enter. That, I think, in a nutshell, shows you how difficult it is to change human behavior. Everybody always wants to say, it's the other guy's problem. I got to get downtown.
So what works? What have we found, just talking about the car, policies that work? You point out that technical fixes aren't keeping up with the sheer increase in numbers of automobiles, things like electric cars or fuel-efficient cars or catalytic converters.
Yeah, that is actually, I'm glad you mentioned that, because that's a good example of the limits of technology. We've had actually some pretty impressive improvements on, if you will, the tailpipe technology, reducing the amount of pollution that comes out of the tailpipe, air pollution. So our skies here in the United States in particular are cleaner, but we are putting up still a lot of carbon dioxide to cause global warming. And even if you move to the fuel cell cars, which, you know, produce basically the only exhaust is water, you still are going to have the big problem of congestion. And to my mind, both in the United States and around the world, that is what is really going to be the problem of the car over the next 10 years. People getting more and more infuriated that this car, which is supposed to be a source of mobility, you know, is essentially a magic carpet in theory, suddenly you're stuck in traffic and you can't get where you want to go. Now, we've got to change policies at a very fundamental level to improve that. We've got to begin to really make public transport, mass transit, something that gets, instead of $1 out of every 7 federal dollars, it should be reversed. Right now we put 6 out of $7 into highways, and we've got to make a much more equal distribution, and we've got to change our land use policies. But these are very long-term kinds of social changes, so I think it's going to get a lot worse before it gets better.
I'm talking with journalist Mark Hertzgard. He writes for many national publications, including The New York Times, The New Yorker, The Atlantic Monthly. He's written a new book about environmental change, our attitudes towards the environment and environmental degradation. It's called Earth Odyssey. Let's talk a little bit about population growth. You went to Brazil, and one of the, of course, the big environmental challenges in that country is deforestation. And population growth is often blamed for that. But there's a lot of complex political factors at work, too. How did you go about unraveling how much population matters?
In Brazil, I was there to cover the Earth Summit, and then after that I went up to the Amazon. And I was lucky enough to be running around with some priests who worked up in the Amazon, and I got to know their parishes and the people with them. And I remember one day we were, in fact, I tell this story in the book about traveling downriver with them, and the family who ran their boat had nine kids. And you look at that, and in fact, I got a call from a magazine editor that day saying, hey, why don't you do a story on population? And I said, well, I just got off a boat with a family with nine people. And it seems easy from that point to say, ah, well, that's why all that rainforest is being cut down in Brazil. And I think many Americans take this sort of knee-jerk assumption that it's their problem down there. If they just stop having so many kids, we wouldn't have an environmental crisis. Well, when you look a little more carefully, what you realize in the case of Brazil is that, you know, Brazil actually does not have a terribly dense population out in its rural areas. There's density in Rio de Janeiro and Sao Paulo. But in fact, outside of that, it's a very sparsely populated country. And the reason that the rainforest is being cut down is not that there's too many people, but that there's too little social equality. There's not enough land in Brazil open to peasants. About 50% of the land is owned by 1% of the population. And I met a lot of land squatters who would say, look, we got kicked off of the farm where we were working for the rancher, and what could we do? The only option we had was to go into the rainforest and to cut down some rainforest to create cropland for ourselves. Unfortunately, the soil is so weak there in the tropical areas that after about 2 or 3 years, it doesn't produce anymore. They have to go further into the rainforest, cut down more trees, and it becomes a vicious circle. And the solution to this is, again, quite straightforward: land reform. You've got to more equally distribute the land. There's plenty of land there. It's just being used improperly now.
Now, what do you think the consequences are for that kind of attitude among people? You went back to the United States and you had someone say exactly that to you. Hey, look, it's not our fault. You know, these people are so badly off in Brazil. Why don't they stop having so many kids? What do you say back to people like that?
That was a friend of mine who said that. I was passing through San Francisco on the way to Brazil. And when he said that, I had to bite my tongue because it's part of the reason that people outside of America sometimes get infuriated with Americans, because the Americans tend to not know very much about the rest of the world and to be especially blind to our own environmental burdens. The fact is that the average American baby, because we live such a much more material, excessive life, the average American baby, over the course of his or her lifetime, will produce 13 times as much pollution, will use 13 times as many natural resources as a Brazilian baby. So my friend who said that, who had two kids, if you multiply 2 by 13, he essentially had 26 kids. Compared to João and Margarita, who had the 9 children, you know, he had 3 times as much environmental burden as they did. So population is important. But it is by no means the most important aspect of the environmental crisis. And I would just say that Americans have to be careful about throwing stones when you live in a glass house.
Mark Hertzgard, thanks very much for talking with me on Fresh Air.
Thanks for having me.
Mark Hertzgard's new book is Earth Odyssey, Around the World in Search of Our Environmental Future. This is Fresh Air.